Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do Thomas Dalton's translation of Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. We're going to do about half of Chapter 9 of Volume 2. Chapter 9 is called Basic Ideas Regarding the Meaning and Organization of the SA, the Sturmabteilung. Storm troops, the storm division. So this will be recording number 27. Again, chapter 9 will do about the first 10 sections. It's about average length, about 15 pages maybe. Chapter 9, basic ideas regarding the meaning and organization of the SA. Picks up on page 571. The strength of the old state rested on three pillars: the monarchical state form, the civil service, and the army. The king, the army, the civil service, he said, were the three good things about the old Reich. He said that before, last volume. Here he says the strength of the old state rested on those three pillars: the monarchical state form, that is the king, the civil service, like his father was part of, and the army. The 1918 revolution abolished the state form, changed it from a monarchy to a republic, dissolved the army, and abandoned the civil service to party corruption. Thus, the essential supports of the so-called state authority were shattered. This authority nearly always depends on the three elements which lie at the basis of all authority. 9.1. Three bases of authority, and we're going to do up through 9.10. 9.1. Three bases of authority. Popularity is always the first basis for the creation of authority. But an authority resting on that basis alone is quite frail, uncertain, and shaky. Hence, everyone who finds himself vested with an authority based only on popularity must improve and consolidate the foundation of that authority by the creation of power. Accordingly, we must look upon power, that is, force, as the second basis of all authority. So popularity and then force. This is more stable and secure, but not always stronger than the first. If popularity and force are united together and can endure for a certain time, then an authority may arise that's based on a still stronger foundation, namely the authority of tradition. And finally, if popularity, force, and tradition are united, then the authority may be seen as invincible. Popularity, authority, tradition. Popularity, power, or force. Popularity, power, and tradition. Popularity, force, and tradition. Together, invincible. But the revolution totally abolished this last case. There was no longer even an authority of tradition. With the collapse of the old Reich, the elimination of the old state form, and the destruction of the old sovereign emblems and Reich symbols, tradition was shattered. The result was the harshest shaking of state authority. The second pillar of state authority, force, also ceased to exist. In order to carry out the revolution, capital R, it was necessary to dissolve that which embodied the organized force and power of the state, namely the army. Indeed, some fragments of the army itself had to be used as revolutionary fighting elements. The armies at the front weren't subjected in the same degree to this disintegration, but as they gradually receded from the fields of glory on which they had heroically fought for 4.5 years, they were attacked by the homeland's acid of disintegration. Picking up Wagner and others. And when they arrived at the demobilizing centers, they fell into that confusion of the so-called voluntary obedience in the time of the soldiers' councils. Again, that's what a Soviet is, a Soviet worker or Soviet is a council. And remember, Marx thought the revolution would take place first in Germany, not in Russia. But they're trying to repeat what they had just done or carried off in the Soviet Union. Or in Russia, it wasn't the Soviet Union for like 5 years, I guess, but still the same idea. They're trying to do the same thing in Germany, and he's saying, okay, they're getting demobilized after the war, and there's a lot of confusion. Of course, no authority could be based on this crowd of mutinous soldiers who looked upon military service as an 8-hour workday. Therefore, the second element, that which guarantees the stability of authority, was also abolished, and the revolution had only the original element, popularity, on which to build its authority. But this basis was extraordinarily insecure. The revolution shattered the old state structure with a single blow, but only because the normal balance was within the social structure of the nation had already been eliminated by the war. The normal balance within the social structure of the nation. 9.2. Three classes of national bodies. Three classes of national bodies. Every national body is made up of three classes, three main classes. At one extreme, we have the best of the people, meaning those who possess all virtues, particularly courage and self-sacrifice. At the other extreme are the worst dregs of humanity, in whom vice and selfishness prevail. Between these two extremes stand the third class, made up of the broad middle stratum, who embody neither radiant heroism nor vulgar criminality. The times of a nation's rise are marked exclusively and only exist by the absolute leadership of the extreme best. Say the top 10% versus the bottom 10% and the middle 80% is how I envision what he's saying. Times of normal and balanced development or of stable conditions owe their existence to the dominating influence of the middle elements. Here the two extreme classes are balanced against one another, canceling each other out. Times of national collapse are determined by the dominant influence of the worst elements. It must be noted here, however, that the broad masses, that which I have called the middle class, come forward and make their influence felt only when the two extreme sections are engaged in mutual struggle. In case of victory for one of the extremes, they readily submit to the victor. If the best dominate, the broad masses will follow them, and if the worst triumph, then they will at least offer no opposition. The middle masses never fight their own battles. And that's true. 9.3, sacrifice of the best. They might be used by others to fight battles, but they don't fight it themselves by their own direction or decision. 9.3, sacrifice of the best. Now, the outpouring of blood for 4.5 years during the war, World War I, destroyed the inner balance between these three classes insofar as it can be said that, admitting the sacrifices of the middle, the class of the extreme best of humanity was almost completely bled out. The truly enormous amount of heroic German blood that was shed during those 4.5 years was irreplaceable. See, again, white brothers war sacrificing themselves, destroying the best of their blood to empower Jews. In hundreds of thousands of cases, it was always, again and again, a call for volunteers to the front, volunteers for patrol, volunteer dispatch carriers, that's what he did, volunteers for bridge building, volunteers for telephone squads, volunteers for the U-boats, volunteers for the airplanes, volunteers for the storm battalions, and so on. Again and again during 4.5 years and on thousands of occasions, there was always the call for volunteers and again for volunteers, and always the same result. Beardless youths or mature men, all filled with an ardent love for their fatherland, with great personal courage or the highest sense of duty, they came forth. Tens of thousands, indeed hundreds of thousands of such cases occurred, and gradually this kind of humanity grew scarcer and scarcer. Those not actually felled were either maimed in the fight or crippled, and thus they crumbled away due to their declining numbers. In 1914, whole armies were composed of so-called volunteers who, owing to a criminal lack of conscience on the part of our feckless parliamentarians, had received no proper training in peacetime, and so were thrown as defenseless cannon fodder to the enemy. The 400,000 who thus fell or were maimed on the battlefields of Flanders couldn't be replaced. Their loss was something far more than merely numerical. With their death, the scales, which were already too light on the good side, now shot upwards toward baseness, treachery, and cowardice. In short, toward the mass of the extreme bad. And there was something more. While for 4.5 years our extreme best were being horrendously thinned on the battlefields, our extreme worst succeeded wonderfully in saving themselves. For each hero who made the supreme sacrifice and ascended the steps of Valhalla, there was a slacker who cunningly dodged death in order to engage in business that was more or less useful at home. And so, the end of the war gave us the following picture. The broad middle stratum of the nation gave its share of blood sacrifice. The extreme best, with outstanding heroism, sacrificed themselves almost completely. The extreme bad preserved themselves almost completely. So one sacrificed completely, one preserved itself, covered its ass completely by taking advantage of absurd laws and because of the non-application of articles of war. This well-preserved scum of our nation then made the revolution and could do so only because the extreme best elements were no longer there to oppose it. They were no longer alive. 9-4, the resulting disorganization. Hence, the German Revolution, from the very start, was only conditionally popular. This act of Cain wasn't committed by the German people, per se, but by Cain and Abel from the Bible, killing his brother. This act of Cain, the revolution, wasn't committed by the German people, per se, not the Germans in themselves, but by an obscure rabble of deserters, hooligans, and so on. The man at the front welcomed the end of the bloody struggle and was happy to return and see his wife and children once again, but he had no interconnection with the revolution. He didn't like it, nor did he like its instigators and organizers. During the 4.5 years of that bitter struggle, he forgot the party hyenas and all their wrangling became foreign to him. The revolution was really popular only with a small part of the German people, namely that class of accomplices who had selected the backpack as the hallmark of all honorable citizens in this new state. They didn't like the revolution for its own sake, as many still erroneously believe today, but because of its consequences. I'm not quite sure what he means by the backpack as the hallmark of all honorable citizens. The accomplices scene. And that's interesting because of all the people who walk around with backpacks today, a big thing you see with coloreds in general. But it was very difficult to establish any authority on the popularity of these Marxist gangsters. Remember, popularity, power, or force, and tradition are the bases of authority. And yet the Young Republic, so the Marxists weren't popular, but they had some force, and yet the Young Republic needed authority at any cost, unless it was ready to be overthrown after a brief chaos by a retributive force assembled from the last elements among the best of our people, that is, the demobilized soldiers, the Freikorps. Those responsible for the revolution feared nothing more than to lose a foothold amidst the turmoil they had created and to be suddenly seized by an iron fist, as has happened more than once at such junctures in the life of peoples. The Republic had to be consolidated at any price, sort of parallel to the way Lenin had to, or they had to do Brest-Litovsk in Russia, to preserve the revolution, that is, sign a peace treaty with Germany so they could focus on their communist revolution. Hence, it was almost immediately forced to erect, alongside its wavering pillar of popularity, an organization of force in order to secure a firmer authority. In those days of December, January, and February 1918-1919, the matadors of the revolution felt the ground trembling beneath their feet, and they looked around them for men who, through love of their people, would strengthen them by force of arms. The anti-militaristic, as they called it, republic needed soldiers. But the first and only pillar of their state authority, namely their popularity, was grounded only on a society of hooligans, thieves, burglars, deserters, slackers, etc. Therefore, it was useless to look within that extreme worst portion of the nation for men willing to sacrifice their lives in the service of a new ideal. The class supporting the revolutionary idea and carrying out the revolution was neither able nor willing to call in the soldiers to protect it. This class had no wish whatsoever to organize a Republican state, but to disorganize what already existed in order to better satisfy their own instincts. Their watchword was not the organization and construction of the German Republic, but rather the plundering of it. Hence the cry sent for help by the public representatives in agony went unheard. Indeed, on the contrary, it aroused bitterness and resistance. The revolutionaries looked upon this as a breach of faith and trust. In the building up of an authority no longer based on popularity but on force, they saw the beginning of a hostile move against what the revolution essentially meant for those elements, against the right to rob, and against unconditional rule by a horde of thieves and plunderers, in short, the worst rabble, who had broken out of prison and left their chains behind. The public representatives could cry out as much as they liked, but no one stepped forward. Come save our revolution, the soldiers like, no, you're scum. Only the counter-try, traitor, came from those popular supporters. The Jews always call you traitor if you don't support their agenda. Then, for the first time, large numbers of young Germans appeared who were ready once again to button on the military uniform in the service of peace and order, shouldering the carbine rifle and donning the steel helmet to oppose the destroyers of their homeland. As volunteer soldiers, they formed into Free Corps, the Freikorps, and, although hating the revolution, began to defend and thus, in practice, to secure it, again, allowing themselves to be used by the Jew Marxist. They acted in the best of faith, says Hitler. The real organizer of the revolution and its actual wire puller, the International Jew, had correctly sized up the situation. The German people were not yet ripe to be drawn into the bloody swamp of Bolshevism, as happened in Russia. This was because there was a closer racial union between the German intellectual classes and the manual workers. Also, the broad social strata were permeated with cultured people, such as was the case also in the other Western European countries, but was completely lacking in Russia, where there you'd have a nobility, a very wide divide between the nobility, speaking French even, and the serfs, who were essentially basically recently freed from slaves only in the 1860s. But still retained a lot of that mentality. There, the intelligentsia were mostly of non-Russian nationality, or at least they didn't have Slavic racial characteristics. The thin upper layer of intellectuals that then existed in Russia could have been abolished at any time because there was no intermediate stratum connecting it with the great mass of people. There, the mental and moral level was frightfully low, and what happened after the revolution, as we know from Solzhenitsyn, listen to our audiobook on same, is that when the revolution was achieved, Jews flooded in from the Pale of Settlement and other places into the big cities, St. Petersburg, Moscow, and such, and effectively replaced Russians and became the main middle and lower level administrators of the new Soviet state. And Hitler is saying this is possible because there's not such a connection between the Russian elite and the masses, which are recently freed serfs. And he's also saying just in general, the cultural level wasn't as high. You didn't have a sort of a middle high, upper middle class type level of cultured people, and maybe in Russia so much as you have in Western Europe. And this gave the Jews an opening. In Russia, the moment the agitators were successful in inciting the uneducated hordes of the broad masses, who couldn't read or write, against the thin upper layer of intellectuals, who weren't in contact with the masses or permanently linked with them in any way, at that moment the destiny of the country was decided and the revolution succeeded. Then the illiterate Russian became the defenseless slave of his Jewish dictators, who, for their part, were shrewd enough to name their dictatorship the People's Dictatorship. Pretending to be acting in the name of the people or the community. That's not who we are is actually a version of this. They are going to define who we are, and we always support the Jew agenda and are always anti-white. If you let them get away with it, they will. If we let them get away with it, they will. 9-5, deserters and revolution. In Germany, there was an additional factor. Just as surely as the revolution could be carried out only by the gradual disintegration of the army, so too the real conductor of the revolution wasn't the soldier at the front, but the light, shy rabble who were either quartered in the home garrisons or were working away as, quote-unquote, indispensables somewhere in the business world, the ramps, rear echelon motherfuckers if they were in the army, or people who somehow got out of military service. The army was reinforced by 10,000 deserters who, without running any particular risk, could turn their backs on the front. At all times, the real coward fears nothing more than death. But at the front, he faced death every day in 1,000 different ways. There has always been only one possible way of making weak or wavering men, or even downright cowards, face their duty. The deserter must understand that his desertion will bring upon him the very thing he's escaping from. At the front, a man may die, but the deserter must die, in italics. Only this draconian threat against any attempted desertion can have a terrifying effect not merely on the individual, but also on the whole. Therein lay the meaning and purpose of the Articles of War. It was a fine belief to think that the great struggle for national existence could be fought solely on a voluntary loyalty arising from and sustained by a realization of necessity. The voluntary fulfillment of one's duty has always determined the best men, but not the average. So only the best are able to have self-discipline. Remember what he spoke about that as one of the key elements of education. Make your body firm, then make your will firm. And last, worry about your intellect. And he's saying that the best can be self-motivated and self-disciplined, but the average needs something external. The voluntary fulfillment of one's duty has always determined the best men, but not the average. Hence, special laws are necessary, as, for instance, against stealing, which were not made for men who are fundamentally honest, but for those who are weak and unstable elements. Such laws are meant to hinder the wrongdoer through their deterrent effect, and thus prevent a condition from arising in which the honest man is considered the more stupid, and which would end in the belief that it's better to participate in theft than to stand by with empty hands or allow oneself to be robbed. It was a mistake to believe that, in a struggle which, according to all human foresight, might last for years to come, it would be possible to dispense with those instruments that the experience of centuries and even millennia have proven to be effective in making weak and unstable men fulfill their duty in difficult times and at moments of great nervous stress. For the voluntary war hero, it's obviously unnecessary to have articles of war, but it is for the cowardly egoists who value their own lives more than in the whole in the hour of national need. Such spineless weaklings can be deterred from yielding to their cowardice only by the application of the harshest penalty. When men have to struggle with death every day and remain for weeks in mud-filled trenches, often with the worst of food, the wavering soldier cannot be held in line by threats of imprisonment or even penal servitude, but only by a ruthless application of the death penalty. Experience shows that, at such a time, he considers prison 1,000 times more preferable than the battlefield. In prison, at least, his precious life is not in danger. The practical abolition of the death penalty during the war, and thus the suspension of the Articles of War, was a terrible mistake. Abolishing the death penalty and the Articles of War that would have put that in writing was a terrible mistake. An army of deserters poured into the reserve stations or returned home, especially in 1918, and helped to form that huge criminal association that we suddenly faced, huge criminal organization that we suddenly faced after 7 November 1918, and which created the revolution. The front had nothing to do with all this. Naturally, those there were yearning for peace, but it was precisely this fact that presented an exceptional danger for the revolution. When the German armies drew near to the home after the armistice, the anxious revolutionaries asked the same question again and again. What will the frontline troops do? Will the field grays stand for it? During those weeks, the German Revolution was forced to appear moderate, at least outwardly, if it weren't to run the risk of being wrecked in an instant by a few German divisions. At that time, if even a single divisional commander, with the help of his loyal division, had made up his mind to tear down the red rags and put the councils up against the wall, and to break any resistance with trench mortars and hand grenades, that division would have grown into an army of 60 divisions in less than 4 weeks. The Jewish wire pullers were more terrified of this than anything else. And precisely to prevent this, they had to give the revolution a certain aspect of moderation. They couldn't call it Bolshevism, so they had to put it under a pretense of peace and order. Hence, many important concessions, the appeal to the old civil service and to the heads of the old army, they were needed at least for a while, and only after the Moors had done their duty could they, the Jews, give them the kick they deserved and take the Republic out of the hands of the old state servants and deliver it to the claws of the revolutionary vultures. They thought that this was the only plan that would succeed in duping the old generals and old civil servants and disarm any eventual opposition beforehand through the apparent innocence and mildness of the new regime. Practical experience has shown how far this succeeded. The revolution, however, wasn't made by the elements of peace and order, but rather by those of riot, theft, and plunder, and the development of the revolution didn't align with their intentions, nor, for tactical reasons, was it possible to explain the course of events to them, nor could it be made acceptable. 9.6. Collaboration of the leftist parties. As social democracy gradually grew, it progressively lost the character of a brutal revolutionary party. Not that it wanted any other goal than revolution, or that its leaders had any other intention, by no means. But what finally remained was only an intention, and a body no longer suited to carry it out. A revolution cannot be carried out by a party of 10 million. In such a movement, one no longer has extreme activity, but rather the broad masses of the middle, and hence inertia. Recognizing all this already during the war, the Jews caused a famous split in social democracy. That is, while the Social Democratic Party, conforming to the inertia of its mass, hung like a leaden weight on national defense, the radical activist elements were extracted from it and formed into new aggressive assault columns. The Independent Party and the Spartacus League were the storm battalions of revolutionary Marxism. Their objective was to create a fait accompli upon which the masses of the Social Democratic Party could take their stand, having spent decades preparing for all this. The cowardly bourgeoisie were dismissed by the Marxists and treated en canaille, as a pack of dogs. No one took any notice of them, knowing full well that, in their canine submissiveness, the representatives of an old and worn-out generation wouldn't be able to offer any serious resistance. So they built up this giant Social Democratic Party. Now they're going to take out the teeth of it, which is the essentially the Antifa, the fighters, the Marxists, and the rest will just do whatever they tell them. So they'd be the counterparty. He's starting to explain the background of why he's building the SA here, of course. It's going to need to fight these revolutionary Marxists. When the revolution had succeeded and the main pillars of the old state had been broken down, the frontline army began to appear as a terrifying sphinx, and thus the natural development of the revolution had to be slowed. The bulk of the Social Democratic Army occupied the conquered positions, and the Independent Socialist and Spartacist storm battalions were pushed aside. But that didn't happen without a struggle. The activist assault formations that had started the revolution were dissatisfied and felt betrayed. They now wanted to continue the fight on their own account, but their unruly hooliganism became odious even to the wire pullers of the revolution. It was scarcely over when two camps appeared, the party of peace and order and the group of bloody terror. But he said even the peace and order were just thieves and plunderers. Bums. Was it not natural that our bourgeoisie should rush with flying colors to the camp of peace and order? Now, for once, their piteous political organizations found it possible to act, inasmuch as the ground had been prepared for them to get a new footing, and thus, to a certain extent, join in a power coalition that they hated, but, even more so, feared. The German political bourgeoisie achieved the high honor of being able to sit at the table with the accursed Marxist leaders to combat Bolshevism. Capitulation of the bourgeoisie. Thus, the following state of affairs took shape as early as December 1918 and January 1919. A minority of the worst elements had made the revolution, and they were immediately backed by all the Marxist parties. The revolution itself outwardly appeared moderate, which aroused the anger of the fanatical extremists. They began to launch hand grenades and fire machine guns, occupying public buildings and thus threatening the moderate revolution. To prevent this terror from developing further, a truce was concluded between the representatives of the new regime and the adherents of the old order in order to wage a common fight against the extremists. The result was that the enemies of the Republic ceased to oppose the Republic as such and helped to subjugate those who were also the enemies of the Republic, though for quite different reasons. But a further result was that all danger of a fight by the adherents of the old state against the new was now definitely averted. This fact must always clearly be kept in mind. Only by recalling it can we understand how it was possible that a nation in which 9/10 of the people hadn't joined in a revolution, where 7/10 repudiated it and 6/10 hated it, how this revolution could be imposed upon them by the remaining 1/10. Minority rule, it's been called. Gradually, the Spartacist barricade fighters petered out, as did the nationalist patriots and idealists on the other side. As these two groups steadily dwindled, the masses of the middle, as always, triumphed. The bourgeoisie and the Marxists acknowledged the facts on the ground, and the Republic began to be consolidated. At first, however, that didn't prevent the bourgeois parties from propounding their monarchist ideas for a while, especially at the elections, whereby they conjured up spirits of the past to encourage and ensnare their own feeble-hearted followers. Honesty it was not. In their hearts, they had broken with the monarchy long ago, and the filth of the new regime had begun to extend its corruptive influence to the bourgeois parties. The common bourgeois politician now feels better in the slime of Republican corruption than in the harsh decency of the forgotten state. 9-8. Why did the revolution succeed? As already stated, after the destruction of the old army, the revolution led to the enforced creation of a new power factor to ensure state authority. As things were, it could do this only by winning over the adherents of a worldview that was in direct contradiction. From those elements alone, it was possible to slowly create a new army that, limited externally by the peace treaties, like 100,000 men or whatever it was, and vastly cut back shipping, was subsequently transformed in spirit into an instrument of the new state conception. Putting aside the question of how, apart from the defects of the old state, which were the real causes of the revolution as a political act could succeed, we arrive at the following conclusions. 1. It was due to a paralysis of our conceptions of duty and obedience. And 2. It was due to the cowardly passivity of our so-called state-preserving parties. To this, the following must be added. The paralysis that attacked our concepts of duty and obedience was fundamentally due to our wholly non-national and purely state education. From this arises the confusion of means and ends. Consciousness of duty, fulfillment of duty, and obedience are not ends in themselves, any more than the state is an end in itself. They all ought to be employed as a means to facilitate and assure the existence on this earth of a community of spiritually and physically homogeneous people. At an hour when a nation is manifestly collapsing, and when it appears as the victim of ruthless oppression, thanks to the conduct of a few scoundrels, then to obey these people and fulfill one's duty toward them is mere doctrinaire formalism and indeed pure folly. On the other hand, the refusal of obedience and so-called fulfillment of duty in such a case might save the nation from collapse. According to our current bourgeoisie, our bourgeois state conception, if a divisional general received an order not to shoot, he acted dutifully and thus rightly in not shooting, because in the bourgeois world, blind formal obedience is more valuable than the life of a nation. But according to the National Socialist conception, it isn't obedience to weak superiors that should prevail at such moments, but obedience to the national community. In such an hour, it's the duty of personal responsibility toward the whole nation that comes to the fore. The revolution succeeded because that concept had ceased to be a living concept with our people, or rather with our government, and gave way to something that was merely formal and doctrinaire. On the second point, the following must be said. The deeper reason for the cowardice of the state-preserving parties is the fact that the most active and well-intentioned section of our people died in the war. Apart from that, the bourgeois parties, which may be considered as the only political formations that stood by the old state, were convinced that they ought to defend their principles only by intellectual ways and means, since the use of physical force was permitted only by the state. That outlook was a sign of a gradually developing weakness and decadence. But it was also senseless at a time when there was a political adversary who had long ago abandoned that standpoint and instead openly declared that he meant to attain his political ends by force whenever possible. And that is exactly the situation we're in the USA right now. The left ignores the law and has for decades, and the right keeps saying keep it legal and other stupidities. Anyone who says keep it legal is exactly the cowardly bourgeois he's talking about. What Hitler said, who was not a cowardly bourgeois, was that he would keep it legal so long as the state did. And the state never does. Almost never. Not in any of these times described, and not in our times. When Marxism emerged in the world of bourgeois democracy, as one of its results, the bourgeois democratic appeal to fight Marxism with intellectual weapons was an absurdity that would soon bring dire consequences. Marxism always professed the doctrine that the use of arms was purely a matter of expediency and that success justified their use. This stuff is all on page 583. This idea was proven correct in the days from 7 to 11 November 1918. The Marxists did not then bother themselves in the least about parliament or democracy, but they gave the death blow to both through their yelling and shooting mob of criminals. 7 to 11 in 1918, they gave the death blow to parliament and democracy through their yelling and shooting mob of criminals. It goes without saying that, at the same time, the bourgeois talking clubs were defenseless. And maybe that's some good rhetoric there to use against the conservatives who infest white nationalism, the bourgeois talking clubs. 9.9, capitulation of Marxism. After the revolution, the bourgeois parties changed the name of their firm and suddenly reappeared, with heroic leaders emerging from dark cellars and airy storehouses where they had sought refuge. But, like all representatives of such institutions, they had not forgotten their errors or learned anything new. Their political program lay in the past, even though they became reconciled to the new regime. Their aim was to participate in the new establishment, and their sole weapon continued to be, as always, words. Also, after the revolution, the bourgeois parties capitulated miserably to the street. When the law for the protection of the Republic was introduced, the majority was not at first in favor of it. But confronted with 200,000 demonstrating Marxists, the bourgeois statesmen were so terrified that they voted for the law against their wills because they feared that they might get their heads smashed by the enraged masses on leaving the Reichstag. Unfortunately, this never took place. And so the new state developed along its own course as if there were no national opposition at all. The only organizations that, at that time, had the strength and courage to face Marxism and its enraged masses were, first of all, the Volunteer Corps, and later, the Organizations for Self-Defense, the Civic Guards, and finally, the Tradition Leagues. but their existence didn't appreciably change the course of German history for the following reasons. Just as the so-called national parties lacked influence because they had no force that could effectively demonstrate in the street, so too the defense leagues couldn't exercise any influence because they had no political ideal, and especially because they had no real political goal. They just didn't like what was going on. Marxism's success was due to a perfect combination of political will and ruthless brutality. What excluded nationalist Germany from shaping German development was the lack of a determined cooperation between brute force and a wise political will. Whatever the will of the national parties may have been, they had no power at all to fight for this will, least of all in the streets. The defense leagues had power at their disposal, and they were masters of the street and of the state, but they lacked political ideals and goals for which their forces might have been or could have been employed in the interests of the German nation. The cunning Jew was able, in both cases, by his clever persuasion and persistence, to reinforce a pre-existing tendency to make this unfortunate state of affairs permanent. The Jew succeeded in using his press for promoting the idea that the defense leagues were of a non-political character, in apostrophes, just as in politics he was always astute enough to praise and encourage the purely intellectual character of the struggle. Millions of German idiots then repeated this nonsense without having the slightest idea that, by doing so, and for all practical purposes, they were disarming and delivering themselves, defenseless, to the Jew. So whenever you hear this kind of garbage language, that anything that says there's no fighting involved is lying to you and leaving you at the feet, unarmed, of the Marxist Jew, which is basically redundant. So anyone talking about intellectual battle or intellectual fighting or marketplace of ideas or all this garbage is evading the point, which is that you have to know where you're going. You have to be willing to fight to get there because you have an opponent who knows where he's going and is willing to fight to get there and will use his control of the mass, control of these cowardly bourgeois politicians to confuse the people you need on your side, we need on our side to actually fight back and win. And finally, the last section we'll do today, there's this pretty thick stuff. You got to think about it. We don't want to do it all in one rush. 9:10. No fighting power without an idea. No fighting power without an idea. But there's a natural explanation for this as well. The lack of a great creative renewing idea, has always meant a limitation in fighting power. The conviction of the right to employ even the most brutal weapons is always associated with an ardent faith in the necessity of victory for a revolutionary new order on earth. A movement that doesn't fight for such highest aims and ideals will never have recourse to the ultimate weapon. The appearance of a new and great idea was the secret of success in the French Revolution. The Russian Revolution owes its triumph to an idea. Only the idea enabled fascism to triumphantly subject a whole nation to a process of complete renovation. Bourgeois parties are incapable of this. It wasn't only the bourgeois parties that fixed their aim on a restoration of the past, but also the defense leagues as well, insofar as they concerned themselves with political aims at all. The old veterans clubs and Kiffhäuser tendencies lived within them, and thereby helped to politically blunt the sharpest weapons that the German nation then possessed, and allowed them to languish in the hands of Republican serfs. The fact that they had the best of intentions in doing so, and certainly acted in good faith, doesn't alter in the slightest bit the foolishness of their actions. So again, he's constantly showing you that the Marxists have political will, have a program, and are willing to fight. They know where they're going. They're willing to fight to get there. We need a force to counter that, who's willing to fight and knows where it's headed. Like an all-white nation, completely free of Jews. That's what we demand for our people. That's the idea. That's what men will fight for. And Trump is, to his credit, getting a little bit without it giving him any intention, because it serves simply his ego. But when he gets those masses of people together, that's where it comes from. Ability to get these masses of people and say, we're going to actually fight, show up in D.C. on this date, and we're going to fight, and we're going to take it over, and we're going to create a new white nation. That's what has to happen, something like that, or whether it's in France or Germany today or any other white nation where the Jews have taken control. But this is what he's saying. He's saying all these stupid conservatives, these bourgeois cowards, are incapable of what needs to be done. It's just parliament and careers and, you know, words and intellectual battles. This is exactly what we see in white nationalism. I don't care where you look, whether it's the Catholics who are more or less openly calling for cowardice, E. Michael Jones types, or the faggots who wanted everything to be a debating club, like Greg Johnson, or the ones who call themselves white nationalists and won't even mention the Jew, and who allow teenagers to push them off their podium, such as Polished Turd Taylor. These are what Hitler is talking against. You have to be willing to fight physically, and you have to know where you're actually going. Oh, we're going to change the culture with our wonderful books and essays. And, you know, they're all deplatformed. They got tiny audiences. And it has no effect. So Hitler is still right today. I think there could have been a footnote there from Dalton to explain what Kiffhäuser tendencies is, because I don't know what it is. K-Y-F-F-H-A-U-S-E-R with an umlaut over the U. So A-U with an umlaut over the U is pronounced oi. Kiffhäuser, more or less. Anyway, it doesn't really matter, though. It's a tiny thing. But the point here is to take that the bourgeois will not fight. It will all be intellectuals written for each other, speaking to each other behind closed doors. So look, everything, I was mocking this the other day on more essays, more conferences. We've already had the books written. We've already had the essays written. We already know we have the talking points. We have the agenda. We know what we want, but who's willing to fight for it? We have to organize and physically fight for it. Or we can passively sit by and wait for some technical solution to it as the U.S. empire falls apart. But I don't think that's wise either. We use the elements in the technical change through the money, particularly Bitcoin, to help our cause. But we do have to fight, I believe. Marxism gradually acquired the authority to enforce its power over the Reichswehr, that's the army under the new setup after the monarchy's done, and then it proceeded consistently and logically to abolish these defense leagues that seemed so dangerous. Some rash leaders who defied orders were summoned to court and sent to prison, but they all got what they deserved. So systematically, so temporarily, the Jews realized, like, hey, we're going to precipitate an anti-revolution if we're not careful, so we'll appear to be moderate for a while until we firmly establish this new republic, and then we will essentially disbar, disembody, disorganize, dismantle every formal organization that is likely to oppose us or from which opposition is likely to come. That's what they've succeeded in the U.S. There's no organized body representing whites of any real stature. Because they've dismantled it, and they've even gone so far as to weed anyone out of the army they could possibly find who exhibited any kind of tendency, whether through tattoo or whatever they displayed it, that might end up opposing Jewish power. So we're in a reduced circumstance, although there are more objective reasons than ever to come together and fight for our racial national interests. That will do it for today. This has been recording 27 from Dalton's translation of Hitler and his Mein Kampf, Volume 2. This was Volume 2, Chapter 9, Section 9.1 to 9 through 9.10. And next session, we will finish Chapter 9. But think about all this in relation to America or in relation to what's going on in your country today. It could even be your country, could be Sweden or any of these smaller countries. Think about what you need to do to oppose Marxism. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.